Meditieren, Yoga, Joggen, nichts entspannt mich.
Echt? Mich entspannt meine Steuer total.
Steuer? Wie Finanzamt? Die Steuererklärung?
Ja, ich habe ganz locker über 1000 Euro zurückbekommen.
Hast du geheime Connections oder Excel-Superkräfte?
Nö, nur die Wieso-Steuer-App.
Wow, und das ist einfach?
Klar, die macht fast alles automatisch.
Ich fühle mich plötzlich so entspannt.
Hol dir dein Geld zurück. Abgabefrist 31. Juli.
Was?
Schaffst du ganz entspannt mit Wieso-Steuer.
Ach, ja.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 30, Episode 19. Coming up on the show, we've got Psychic Lightning, The Whispers of the Desert Wraiths, and The Children of the Invisibles. I'm your host, Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
What a book I have for you today, Ben. Although you have to bear with me, I've taken a little bit of a translation license in the way that I put this book together because it's all in Spanish.
I was going to say, how do you know it's a good book when you can't read it?
I had to translate it. I took an entire day to scan and translate it. And it's great. It's really amazing. It's Shadows and Whispers, Strange and Spooky Experiences in Archaeology. And, here we go.
Can you just pronounce it in the proper
Sombrasisoroso? I don't know. So I do apologize as well because my Spanish is even worse than my Thai.
Vivencias extranas tenebrosas en la arqueología. So it's got something to do with archaeology.
The whispers are, what is it? Strange and Spooky Experiences in Archaeology.
Okay.
So it's actually quite humble. So this is actually a collection of experiences, around 30 experiences. It was put together by Luis Alberto Lopez Warrio and Luis Alberto Martos Lopez. And they've essentially done this collection of these 30 or so reports of people that are in the archaeological field and are leading archaeologists, people that are in academic institutions. Much of it focuses on Mexico, but it does go to other locations.
Okay.
Who have been at dig sites and other archaeological locations of significance and importance, and have had very unsettling, sometimes spiritual, sometimes exciting encounters with non-human entities and supernatural forces. So we're going to go into that for
this
episode.
Like cursed tombs.
It's like treasure guardians.
Mummies.
And capturing, accidentally picking up a spirit and bringing it home with you kind of stuff. Like weird healing sessions where balls of light come out and scan you. Going underneath the Pyramid of the Sun in Teotihuacan, and there's this strange tunnel underneath there that has all of this strange activity associated with it, and people seeing strange entities and
so
Incan style things.
Mexican Indiana Jones, basically.
It really is. It really is. But before we get into that, what have you got coming up?
I saw that the long-awaited follow-up to 2019's American Cosmic has been released. Diana Walsh Pasulka's new book, Encounters, Experiences with Non-Human Intelligences. I picked up a copy and was just perusing through today. I was pretty late to pick up a copy. It came out last week. But so far, some pretty amazing stuff in there with an Australian twist as well. And
in what sense? Like reporting on people's experiences from Australia?
Well, if you remember from the previous book, she had a few pseudonyms from the people she was working with.
Yes, yeah.
And one of them was...
Understandably as well.
One of them was Tyler. And Tyler was a NASA, former NASA engineer, who was also now like an entrepreneur, a scientist.
Oh, this is the guy that got rich, right?
Well, this was the guy that would lie down and get downloads from non-human intelligences. At least that's what he claimed, that he was receiving his inspiration, sometimes his business decisions from these altered states of consciousness. And she wrote in the book about how he almost lived like a monk, like a very strict, disciplined, ascetic lifestyle. Didn't watch TV, wasn't influenced by outside information, but really followed this rigorous practice of going into this meditative altered state and making this connection with something. So his identity was eventually exposed. He's the NASA engineer Timothy Taylor, who we've mentioned on previous shows as well. And there was also James was another one of these pseudonyms, who was a molecular biologist who studied exotic metamaterials that possibly came from
crack sources.
Non-human craft. And eventually that was revealed to be Gary Nolan. And so she's often drawn this question about her work of how does she keep making contact with these people?
That's a good question. Did they seek her out?
Well, that seem to be in these really high-ranking inside circles, right, that have access to information that the rest of us could not even dream of. And in fact, that individual, that NASA engineer, Tyler, remember in American Cosmic, he spoke of a hierarchy. And at the top of the hierarchy, this was like a cosmological view, but also his view of human society and our civilization. He saw God at the top, followed by the next rung down, angels and non-human entities. The next rung down from that was intelligence agents, like people involved in the intelligence communities. And the people below that was us regular plebs, right? And then below that you had animals. And this was his hierarchy of beings. And I remember the last time we spoke about that, it was always intriguing. Like, why would you place the people involved in intelligence communities above regular people?
Because they have access to that knowledge.
Right. And so once again, she started to discover these people that are part of that rung that's above us everyday plebs.
But why are they talking to her about it? Wouldn't they be under confidentiality agreements, or there'd be some type of, you know, law or act preventing them from revealing this information?
Well, one of them she was friends with for years.
Right, okay.
And this is one of the stories I'll tell you coming up in the Plus extension. She was friends with this woman for years. This is before she wrote about UFOs. Their kids used to go on playdates together. And on one of these playdates, I think she said they were out picking strawberries or something. And Diana said she was taking photos of the kids. And this friend of hers said, gee, I wish I had photos of myself when I was a kid. And Diana looked at her and said, why don't you have photos of yourself when you're a kid? And she said, oh, my parents never took photos. They couldn't. And so, of course, she asks, what do you mean? Did they not know how to operate a camera? Why couldn't they take photos? And eventually,
no index fingers.
She reveals that they weren't allowed to take photos of the kids
because they were part of an intelligence agency.
And ultimately, she reveals, well, my father was a member of the secret space program. Now, this isn't just some random nobody. This is a published scientist. And when Diana, who used to work in the same department at the university Pasulka was at, who wrote all this, she's a scholar on Western philosophy, a very specific type of Western philosophy about symbols and language.
Sorry to interrupt, though, but when you say secret space program, what do you mean by secret space program? This is not, because for whatever reason, it just took me a second. I'm like, hang on, I'm thinking like high level NASA stuff, but that's
Great question. When you hear the term secret space program, what do you think?
SERPO, which we know isn't true, but I think of that kind of stuff.
You think of SERPO?
Yeah.
I think of Bill Tompkins and sexy Pleiadian space Lamborghinis.
Of course you
I do. Think of David Wilcock and retarded blue avians and all just not. I just think of nonsense.
That's Iago.
I mostly just think of pure nonsense. Like the idea of people traveling back in time and then meeting Barry Soweto, which is actually Barack Obama, who was also part of the secret space program. I think of crazy stuff like that. But Pasulka says it's what she revealed is completely different to what you will hear about in UFO lore. It's completely different to what you read about in conspiracies and things that are bandied about on the internet.
So probably more consistent with like what they're doing with X-45 or 48B or whatever it is, that strange little shuttle that we don't know exactly what it's doing. Right.
Well, this woman that revealed this to her, and Pasulka interviewed her in 2022, and the full interview is in the book, and I'll mention some of the highlights when we get into the Plus extension.
Great.
But this woman at the time was being recruited by the NSA. So it's not, this is a highly intelligent scholar. This is not someone with specialized knowledge. It's not some kooky person on the internet.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So we'll get into that. And also the idea that the whole, the secrets of the UFO phenomenon, this is another interesting thing that she delves into. The secrets of the UFO phenomenon will never be something that you can read about. The answers will never be something you can gain from reading a document. And the reason for this is because it's, To gain the answers to the UFO mystery, you need to be initiated into an oral tradition. And it's the oral tradition that we'll mention in the Plus extension coming up.
How odd.
It's really interesting.
How
and
odd.
Of course, we had high expectations for her work because she's a really, great thinker with this stuff.
Yeah.
And there's some really interesting ideas about how UFO information is actually shared between those that have real knowledge.
And well, I guess you're not going to write it down, because if you write it down, it can be hacked, it can be breached, it can be, you know, spread about.
Well, there's a term that's quite well known, apparently. It's called pencils up.
Oh, I've never heard of that.
And pencils up means whenever you're discussing, like whenever you're having a discussion, it means none of this is to be written down. And the majority of the information is pencils up. It's just oral. It's all orally transmitted.
Interesting.
So you're never going to get this secret document. You're never going to get a stack of papers that reveal the answers. You have to be initiated into people that carry the oral tradition.
Isn't it fascinating, though, in a way? Because it becomes much like some of the ideas that have been put out there about oral traditions, that much like in a tulpic fashion, although it's not a tulpa, but the oral tradition itself becomes its own entity living amongst the culture of the people.
That's
so it's like the culture of the culture of the secrecy, and the people in the know kind of feed the energy of that story, which moves through them.
Well, it's interesting on that note, Basulker actually links it back to Socrates and Plato.
Really?
Because Socrates was very much against the technology of writing. And
interesting.
Didn't want to see it become a part of civilization. And Plato wrote about this as well, essentially outlining how when you learn through the written word, it's different to gnosis, right? And they were talking about gnosis in that you understand something differently when it's a kind of in-person of knowledge.
Well, there's always that saying of, read or get someone to read, that's the bottom level. Show someone, that's the next level. But if you really want them to learn something, you get them to do it.
Mm.
You get them to experience it. And that's how they really do take that on. So maybe this is in the vein of, that kind of concept.
Yeah, and apply that to UFO secrecy. It's pretty weird.
Interesting. Okay, well, I'm looking forward to getting into that a little bit later in the show. And perhaps it will kind of fit nicely with what we're going to be talking about with Shadows and Whispers, Strange and Spooky Experiences in Archaeology. Now, this is my first translated book, so be kind. Because it has been a couple of days of like, I don't even know what that means. I don't know how to translate that.
And pasted it into ChatGPT?
But it's terrible. It's like the whole context of what is trying to be conveyed is kind of like the subtlety, the nuance of what the writer is trying to say is just lost.
So you're just going through gobbledygook to try and pick out stories.
Yeah, I'm like, where's the story? Light being, ball of light. Okay. Oh, goblin. Okay, great. Yeah. Grab that. I just like pull it through.
Just command F goblin.
Oh, I was. I was just like, okay. No, I ended up reading the entire thing, even though it was translated. If you speak Spanish, this is fantastic for you.
Yeah.
Like it really, like you will pick up the full, concept of what's coming through. I think I will try to explain it though. I think it's there. We're almost there.
Did you put the aircon on 25, by the way?
Because so
I'm already sweating. No, you keep going.
All right.
Start telling your story. And I'll
I love it. Just every episode. We've built this studio. We can't get the air conditioning right. Okay. So let's just jump straight into it. And it starts off with this great introduction from the two authors, where they're describing that in the 19th century, you had the realism movement that went through. And it emerged from Europe and it kind of moved through around the world, and it rejected individualism, sentimentality, and exotic elements. And because of this, it's like what we talk about with materialism. Oh, you're back. It's like what we talk about with materialism. You kind of step away from the experiences, much like what I was just talking about, like you step away from the experiences, especially in academia. It always comes about what can you see, what can you hear, what can you feel? It's all about your five senses. It's not what's beyond those senses. So you find, especially today, but some of these stories go back decades, you find that for a lot of academics, they do become really hardline materialists because it's like it's got to be data, it's got to be backed up, it's got to be peer-reviewed, all that kind of stuff. You can't have someone come along and go, well, I was at this dig site and I felt some entity climb inside me while I was digging and take over my body and help me find something incredible. It's like saying something like that is absolutely absurd. And yet, though, it's like an industrial chemist is probably unlikely to have a spiritual experience, right? Unless, of course, they're exposed to some type of chemical explosion. I don't know. And they have a near-death experience. But for archaeologists, and I think we all inherently feel this in some way, right? You don't have to be an archaeologist to feel this. When you go into a site, like a sacred site or a site that has long been abandoned, I think somehow for many of us, you can intuitively feel that there's an energy, there's a, and without even going woo, there's just something about that location. There's a reverence in some locations when there's a silence and you can feel something. So people in the archaeological world, even though they're very much still caught in the materialism, and this is what archaeology became, archaeology is, well, let's infer what we can from what we find. But a lot of archaeologists have been quiet about this, but they've had mystical and magical experiences when they've gone to these locations, they've gone to these sites. So they describe, and I don't know if this is the exact term again because of the translation, but the authors describe this element of magical realism that has emerged in archaeology, particularly in these cases from, you know, Mexico and the Southern Americas. And, you know, it's like where humans are fully integrated into their environments, their worldviews and their beliefs. But this magical realism, it can allow people to step out of that. And it's intertwined, especially in archaeologists, into their daily lives. So they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place of trying to find, well, I've gone to this site and something really strange has happened, but there's no way I can document that.
Right.
You know, or I can document it, but I have to do it in a way that's like, oh, well, I've picked up this bone and, you know, this bone perhaps has come from this, whereas, you know, we find out later on that they've somehow either downloaded that information.
Really?
Or they've had, that's not described in this book, but this is the sorts of experiences that we're going with.
I mean, right? That's what Pasulka talks about quite a lot in American Cosmic and this book is scientists that gain information through paranormal ways, but never reveal it.
Never reveal it.
And there's one example, that woman I was telling you about who claimed her father was part of this secret group, said that throughout her high school and school college schooling, she always found it difficult to explain how she got answers, especially in mathematics. She would always know the answer, but
never show it working.
How to show the working was very difficult. Frustrating for her because the answer was just something that went popped into her head.
Yep. Well, think about it. Like with archaeologists, right? You're down in the earth. Like you're down on your hands and knees. You're not sitting in a lab somewhere. Sometimes you are, but you're not up writing papers like other academics. You know, you're actually there on the ground. And so what's happening? You're touching stuff. And even though, yes, that's a sense, beyond that is the idea of psychometry. Like you're picking up the energies that are around you. And, you know, one particular kind of theme that popped up before I get into some of these stories was that it's fascinating. It's like a new take on the stone tape theory. Of course, you know what the idea of stone tape theory is, that a certain location will absorb, you know, the energies that are around it. So you and I having this conversation right now, Ben, perhaps it will be absorbed into this wall over here and will replay sometime in the future in some weird, you know, ghost-like event. But normally it's associated with more intense emotional kind of events. But in a couple of these stories, it's particularly it applies to archaeology, right? Because archaeologists are not only going into extremely old sites, they're also going into sites that are a couple of hundred years old, or they're going into more modern buildings that have been, you know, renovated previously. And so they start peeling back the stucco and the layers of paint and that kind of stuff. And there's some paranormal researchers that have approached these archaeologists and they're like, are you experiencing paranormal phenomena? And the archaeologists are like, yeah, if you could call it paranormal phenomena, we've had some weird experiences. It's like once you start pulling back the layers, like the modern layers from the older ones of the older original material, it's like it releases the
entities. Oh, really?
And they all come flying out. And being an archaeologist, what are you doing? You're peeling back layer and layer and layer of dirt and substance. And it is actually acts, even though it's spiritual, it acts as a physical barrier. Okay. And so there's
Let's hear the anecdotes. Let's hear the example.
Because there's stories in here of people, like, you know, entities. And of course, they talk about the Elushas, which are like those little, I guess you could call them goblin-like creatures. They're mischievous kind of creatures because they go into these particular locations. They seem to appear. Sometimes they're trapped between worlds. And when you go to an archaeological site and you dig them up, they get released and start causing trouble. But let's jump into some of the earlier cases. And Ben, I want you to bring up for me image one and image two in a moment here. This was quite an intriguing little story. So this relates to, and I can't believe it, it's the first story as well, and I haven't, I've accidentally deleted his name from
the
story.
Oh, good, here we go. Jose.
No, it's not Jose. It's Francisco Galvan, right? He's an archaeologist from the National School of Anthropology and History. And you know, I like his opening kind of story because he says, I dreamt it. He has this dream. And in the dream, and this is what happens to a number of archaeologists in this book as well, their experiences. It's not just what you're experiencing at a dig site. It's what's coming to you in dreams both before and after a certain dig that you go to. And he says, I find myself in this monumentally rocky location on the bank of a river, and I'm excited, but I can see these large figures, these large engraved figures, they're all around me. And this is an incredible discovery that I'm so excited about. And he just wakes up. He just wakes up. He has this feeling. He's like, oh, there's... That was more than a dream. You know, there's something here. So he says this seemingly is a projection of where he's going to go into the Chihuahua Desert, where he's going to go to this particular site. And he's heading to the Boquilla de Conchos. So again, sorry if I destroyed that.
So I'm reckoning what he's saying is Chihuahua Desert?
Chihuahua, yeah.
And Boquilla?
Oh, is it Boquilla? Thank you very much. Perfect. Perfect. Thank you, Ben. So he goes in, and what did I call it before?
Boquilla.
Oh, okay. Anyway, so he travels down into this particular location, and just bring up image number one for me, Ben. So he wants to head. I knew you were going to do that. I heard that being yelled from the office next door. So when he goes to this particular site, right, he finds that there are, you know, these beautiful, and this is a well-known location. It's not like it's anything that is not discovered, right? It's not like he's making this new discovery. But I get the impression here is that the discovery that he has is about the phenomena itself, as opposed to a new site, because when he heads into this location, it's near the river. And as he's down near this river, he says that he gets this like feeling of where there's this like a mirror. He calls it like a stone mirror. And he feels like he's kind of being kind of caught up in it. And he finds himself, you know, just being, he doesn't say it directly, but it's like he has this kind of metaphysical experience. And he says when he wakes up in the morning, he wakes up as if he's reborn. Right, he's just completely reborn. And there was some discomfort that he had in his ear. And he says, the light beings or the beings of light have healed me, because the pain that was in his ear has just completely disappeared. And it's almost like just being in the locale of this particular site and the entities that may be attached to it can do these things for certain people. So he's like, oh, this is incredible. And he's feeling reborn. And he wants to go and photograph the form. So he goes to photograph them. But as he does, he's like, you know, I'm just going to leave my stuff here and I'm just going to go for a wander. So as he goes for a wander, he says he hears this laughter. And he initially thought it was young people down on the river. And he's like, that's actually not people. It's coming from somewhere else. And these beings, he says, this voice tells him, it's coming from nowhere, they will steal your things from the camp.
What the hell?
And he's like, what? So he panics and he goes rushing back in fear to protect his belongings. And he reaches the vicinity of the camp and there's no one there, right? But it turns out that there were kids down at the river, and somehow these beings had seemingly protected him from having his belongings stolen.
Why would there be beings looking out for his archaeological gear? What's in it for them?
It's really strange, right? Because when he says he feels like he's pulled into this mirror, he does have what, and this is again the translation, he's like an explosion of stars, and he's like, something is happening. Like he must be connecting with something at these sites. And this kind of sets the theme for the book, that there's like archaeologists that go to these particular locations sometimes seemingly have a connection with it. Like, but you've got to ask for it as well. And if you go there with an arrogance about yourself, it can have, you know, in some circumstances, very disastrous consequences. But after he's had this experience and he's woken up and he's feeling really great and he's heard these voices, he's just like, there's no explanation for this. But he's kind of, you can tell he's going over it. He's in his head. He's like, no, I didn't hear voices. You know, he's like, no, I can't deceive myself. I heard a voice. Like, I know that something was sheltering me, something from the beyond, but what it is, I don't know. It sits within the, you know, the esoteric. So he heads to the Cave of Monkeys, which was the image there that we put up. This is about 60 kilometers away. And when he goes in there, he claims that he meets a man by the name of Don Socorro. And this guy has an interesting, you know, understanding of this particular location. And while he's there, he lays down. And this guy is like, he's an Indiana Jones type character, because there's another guy there as well. And the dog that's with them just starts drowning. And
what?
This Don is just like, he's okay. Just like, your dog's drowning. And the guy's like, oh my God. So the guy goes running over and he starts drowning as well. And so like with this, like he just pulls out a rope.
Can no one in Mexico swim?
He just pulls out a rope and it's just like throws the rope out and pulls them both out and it's done. Like it's just, and he's just nothing. Like he's not concerned about it at all. Like just really kind of blunt. But he's there, right? And I'm like, why is this relevant? Like, why does this have any relevance?
Because yes, really, why is this relevant?
It really has to set up just how nonchalant this guy is, right? Okay. Because later on, the witness in this particular case, he's like, I fall asleep. And that night, doors open and close and doors open and close. And he finds himself like wandering down this corridor of some kind. It's this long, bright corridor with a misty floor. And I've got to read this directly because he says, as he gets into this space, the space becomes a void and I find that my body is floating. I see intense colored lights and they draw me in with force. I wanted to touch them. And when I did, a beautiful woman with a white dress made of cotton and black hair appeared. I don't think it's made of black hair. I think she has black hair.
Okay, yeah.
So immediately, he says, I approached her and began to kiss her on the face.
What?
I was unhurried.
Bold. I like this is like a Latin confidence.
Oh, I get
when you see
better.
A hot ghost woman, you don't hesitate.
No, you don't hesitate. Like, he's just straight in. He's like, then I kissed her on the mouth and our tongues intertwined and danced together. And then I started to see her lower dress falling down. Lovely brown and firm breasts made an appearance. And I started squeezing them. And savoring them and gently kissing them. So, okay, like he's getting a bit fresh with this weird dream woman. So he's doing it, right? And it's getting a little bit amorous, beyond amorous. When he says, she yielded and wrapped her arms around my neck. Her hands roamed my back and I was experiencing sensual joy until she settled on the back of my neck. And at that moment, her hands squeezed tighter and tighter and pulled her entire lifeless body into mine.
What the hell?
Breathing became difficult. All erotic senses disappeared. And at that moment, I was completely unable to get any air into my lungs. I could not. I was suffocating. I could not get her off me.
Is he being possessed or is this classic old hag the chest?
It's not described, right? It feels like it's something that's at this particular location, right? It's an entity that's at this location. And many of these entities seem to be able to invade the dreamscapes of anyone there, like within a certain distance or whatever intention. So as this is all going on, is the desperation in my face of this suffocating experience is reaching this unbearable limit. And I'm telling myself, I don't want to die this way. I don't want to suffocate on a pair of breasts. And then he says, right,
I can think of worse ways to go.
Her sparse beard scratched my face and her boozy breath made me dizzy and provoked a repulsion translated into nausea.
Her sparse beard?
Yeah. Her sparse beard, right?
So what is going on?
It's not a 60-year-old Italian woman. It's like something else.
Are you sure the story's not talking about his beard?
No. Her beard and boozy breath is making him sick to the point of vomiting. I still couldn't inhale or exhale, nor could I open my eyes. And he starts screaming like he thinks this is it. I'm done.
Is this a Mexican ghost tranny?
So some hand seemingly in this space kind of reaches in and grabs him and pulls him and he's awake. Like he's suddenly awake. And it's this, you know, this Don next to him. And he's like, oh, what's wrong? What's wrong, archaeologist? Are you okay? And he's like, oh, yeah. And you know, after you've had a bad dream and you kind of calm down, you think, oh, how silly that is. You know, it's fine. So he goes back to sleep and nothing else happens. But in the morning, Don Socorro was preparing coffee and he's like, good morning. And he's like, this kind of like look about him. And he's like, oh, you had an episode of El Muerto last night. And he was like, oh, yeah, I must have. But he's like, it wasn't a Murto. It was a Murta. Like, it was a woman, right? Yeah, yeah. It wasn't a man. It was a woman. And he kind of just looks at him and kind of, like, cocks his eye a little bit. And he's like, it was a Murto. And he's like, oh, like a scene out of Ace Ventura.
Yeah,
he's
like, dry reaching. Hang on, this is the opening story of this book?
This is one of the earliest stories in the book, and that's why I'm like, I'm in this, I'm going to keep on going, I've got to go. And it was. He said, it was a man dressed as a woman and you fell for it, right? And he's like,
hang on a second, this is a dream-invading ghost.
Cross-dressing, dream-invading ghost.
Don't ghosts have the ability to just shapeshift? There's so much I don't understand about this.
He's like kissing his tits.
What is going on? Why would you shapeshift to the point where you look like a woman, but then reveal that?
Okay, so what the moral of this story apparently is that when he he keeps on talking to him, and he's like, "You fell for it," and he says, "I decided not to reply. Like, I'm not going to reply to him." But I was left with this unpleasant sensation, and it stayed with me for days. And in fact, writing about this has had me, you know, made me have to relive it again. It was such an unpleasant experience.
What's the El Muerto image you've got here?
So this is essentially what the, there's like folkloric stories about this guy. And apparently he, you know, is an evil kind of figure, like the Hat Man that shows up and attacks people. But even though this particular story is quite horrible for him, he also says that, look, I actually realized I learned something from this. I learned to protect myself before entering any spaces that do not belong to me and to ask permission from the living and dead entities. Intuition tells you whether you should enter or not, and this should be done without questioning it, especially from an egocentric perspective, because that's kind of where he was, right? This is a really, and this is why I think this is so early in the book. And I like this. There's this humbling about, you know, being an archaeologist and so many archaeologists being like, no, like we already have the history. We already know what's already happened and just walking into these sites. But no, it's like, you've got to be careful about this arrogance. Mm. So then later on, bring up image number three, Ben.
Günstig ohne App. Bei Aldi gibt es einen Preis für alle. Diese Woche Bio-Joghurt mit Crispy Müsli, 150 Gramm für nur 89 Cent. Oder Iglo-Rahmspinat, 750 Gramm für nur 1,69 €. Entdecke weitere Angebote in deinem Aldi Nord. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
So this is, I think this is it Chipe Totec? Chipe Totec? So X-I-P-E. So I think that's a chi. So Chipe Totec. So this particular entity, he claims that what he had gone, because he was a photographer, like he focused on archaeological photography. He had gone to this particular location. And I think it was in the Sierra Norte de Puebla. And he said he was quite impulsive and had excessive pride and arrogance about, you know, certain locations. That was the archaeologist in me. And it was this morning and he goes out to this particular site and it's filled with all these figures, much like his dream in a way. He doesn't say directly that it's like the dream, but he finds this site with these figures. It's early January. And all of the sediment that was over this particular like ruin, he says it's all been kind of pulled away and moved away. And he says it was a mask. Like this mask appears with closed eyes as if they seemed like the eyelids were sewn shut. And immediately I identified it as Chipe Totec. And he says he starts photographing it. He's like just taking photographs of it. And this is really strange. And I don't know if it's the because of the translation. But he says the entity, when he took that image, right, that we like it's a flash. And all of a sudden, it's like everything sucked up and the image penetrated into his brain, like struck him into his brain. And he said, once it was inside, it was in my dreams. The entity had completely trapped me. It had overcome me. It wouldn't let me sleep. It governed him every day. It ruled him and it reduced him to a wreck. Now, he says he received death threats. And now I don't know if that was from the entity that was inside him in his head or other people. It apparently invented an affair with an indigenous woman.
What?
He said there was an intense sexual force that was controlling me and I couldn't stop it. More death threats. He would get images like flashes of candles upon his coffin and these things, you know, threatening to attack him. More entities. You know, he was engulfed in a whirlwind of fear. And he's like, what's going to become of me? Like, I'm just... And the guy became a mess. Like, this doesn't, you know, really portray it, just how terrible it seemingly was. Because he just says at the end, I just wanted to be caught and devoured. Nothing else mattered anymore. I was locked in a labyrinth of darkness and I couldn't get out. Now, he says that finally, when he started talking to other people about it, they came forward and did prayers for him and were able to, when they learned of his misfortune, and were able to get him out of this. And he said, I finally saw the light, the calm being of my spirit return to me. And when that happened, the bad taste that was in my mouth also began to fade. So it was causing like a physical effect as all. But it sounds like what had happened was he photographed this site without asking for permission. And it allowed the entity that was protecting this site to get inside him.
Right.
So later on, he speaks to you know, other people that are knowledgeable about this particular entity and this particular site. And one of his friends says to him, look, you went through something extremely spiritually intense, like extremely so, and gives him a book so he can try and kind of remedy what had happened to him. But he says it was quite clear what had occurred. And this entity actually was instructing him, giving him teachings, much like what had happened with the other entity. But that was to understand that these spaces don't belong to us, they belong to them. And it's necessary, once again, to request permission from the location to be able to get access to that particular location. And it's funny because in many of these reports, the way that you can request permission is quite intriguing. Sometimes it's like you could just walk into a site and just say, hey, please forgive us for any mistakes we make, and you try to not, and you shouldn't anyway. Like, you shouldn't desecrate or mess up a site. Or you can do things like give food and alcohol and, right, do these weird kind of things. But then you've got the, we'll skip forward from the shaman. I'll come back to the shaman. Bring up image number 4 for me, please, Ben. This is the ghost of the Church of the Capuchins. And this happened in 1995. So this is a low-res image. I'm sorry. I couldn't get a high-res image of this particular
location.
But this is a project that was conducted for about a period of 10 years of restoration. And there was something very strange that occurred here. So this was Josefina Guerrero, who was the archaeologist, again, at the National Institute of Anthropology and History. And from 1995, she was working in this site and doing restoration work, and putting up scaffolding, not directly herself, but, doing all this kind of stuff, right? But when she was at this particular old church, she claims that it had been a tough year for her. So she was in a psychic kind of state, or not disturbed, but there's pressure there. And so she didn't hesitate to accept this invitation to go and meet up with this man by the name of Eduardo, who was the director of this restoration project. So she goes down there and she goes into this particular site, and it's spectacular. Like, it's a really great opportunity to go into this temple, the Capuchinus temple. And this was built between 1680 and 1738, and it still preserves most of its architecture that's intact, but it has been, affected by fire, much like many of these locations. They're affected by fire over the years. The facade has kind of broken down a little bit. The bell tower, as you can see from the image, it's run down quite a lot. But I'll link to it. If you're not watching the video, I'll link to it so you can see it in the show notes. But when she goes into this site, she describes how, she'd get up and do her work in the morning and everything was good. Until one day, Eduardo came to her, and there's like this altarpiece. And he says, oh, can you draw this for me? Can you draw it to scale? Because that's what she would do for her, archaeology work. She'd do drawings and sketches. And she's like, oh, this is going to be really hard. But yeah, I can do this for you. I would love to do that. And so she accepts, and she starts drawing this altarpiece. Now, around the same time, there's other workers that are there. So you don't just have the academic team. You've also got laborers and workers and people working really hard to, perform all these duties there. And she said that they were acting a little bit odd. She said people would go outside to smoke, and they would kind of form these little cliques and little circles. And she's like, they were keeping silent and tolerating me. But she kind of wondered if she was annoying them. She's like, am I annoying them? Like, why aren't they talking to me? Why aren't they, having any interactions with me? Until finally she confronted one of them. And they said, look, it's not you, but if we tell you, you won't understand. She's like, oh, come on, you can tell me. And he's like, no. So she says, the days passed, and
they seriously didn't tell her. Imagine saying that to someone.
I know. Well, it was just like, no,
sorry, you won't understand.
Sorry, you won't understand. But as she's there, she said that, strange things started happening inside. She said there was this young man with fair skin and light eyes. He suddenly goes through this emotional change. Like, he just takes these few steps back, and he starts extending his right arm, and he's pointing at the wall with his index fingers. Did you see it? Did you see it? Now, she says neither the architect nor myself knew anything that he was talking about, but he was talking in this agitated tone. His name was Joel, she eventually finds out. And he's like, this person passed right in front of us. I just saw him walk in front of us, and he walked into the wall. Like, he walked through the wall. And she's like, come on, this is ridiculous. This isn't happening. And other people, though, started acting weird as soon as this event took place, right? And this guy's new. So it seems like everyone else, and this is what is already inferred, right, that they know that there's some type of haunting or weird activity that's taking place, but she isn't seeing it. And this new guy comes along, and he kind of, introduces her to it, sure, in a roundabout way. So eventually she manages to pin down Eduardo and other people. And she's like, you have to tell me what's going on. I don't know what that was, but you need to tell me. I'm like, okay, fine. Look, when we first arrived here, there was all of these inexplicable and fascinating experiences that were taking place. There were individuals that we would interrupt, and they would pass through us, or they were walking through. But each and every one of us experienced this strange kind of effect where at night while we were asleep, we would feel someone touch us or something touch us, and a heat would invade our bodies and travel through it. And it'd be like a warmth passing up through our bodies, over our face, into our shoulders, then back down to our feet. And as soon as we felt this warmth, when we would wake up, we'd throw our blankets off to see if there was someone there, and there'd never be anyone there. But immediately afterwards, there'd be some type of apparition or an entity that would kind of appear. And she's like, oh, this is incredible. Like, you know, it must be haunted. Like, there must be something going on here. And they're like, oh, yeah, okay. And they kind of leave it, right? They just kind of leave it. And yet this activity continues over and over and over again until you have Alfredo. So Alfredo, who really wasn't a believer in any of this kind of stuff, he was sleeping in one of the offices kind of because it's got these offices that are attached to it. And he wakes up in the middle of the night to find, you know, one of these entities directly in the room with him. Like, it's obvious that this place is completely and absolutely haunted, like it's infested. But this ties in with what I was saying a little bit earlier in the show, that it's like once they've started to remove the layers of this location, it's allowed all the entities to start spewing forth. So it's not like one of the really old sites. It's a relatively new, it's only a couple of hundred years old. But it's because of their restoration work, it's agitating all the spirits and they're all coming loose. So this kind of stuff just goes on for days and days and days and days to the point where essentially they have to leave. Like, they have to get out of there. We have to get away from there. And what happens is there's this guy who utilizes a deep meditation, right? And in utilizing the deep meditation, he seemingly connects with something, right? He connects with the entities that are at this site. And essentially he's a Spanish ghost whisperer, because once he does it, everything disappears. Like, everything dissipates. And everything can return to normal. Like, and this is really great for a while. And then all the workers come back and everyone's calm and like it's all good, except he's one of the lead project leaders. He's really upset because he's like, the guy that came and cleared everything away and got rid of the ghosts, there's nothing fun here anymore. There's nothing exciting here anymore because it got cleared out. It's like he took the ghosts with him. And he did. It's like he took the ghosts with him. So it's kind of like he acted as this ghost whisperer for this particular site. But that's like a more modern kind of report that sits in this book. And there are heaps of those kinds of reports. So you've got like the Palace of Cortez. And in fact, I think you've got it. I don't know which number it is there, Ben, but the Palace of Cortez is this old mansion, essentially. Yeah. So if you look at this site, this is a really spectacular location as well.
Looks like a fort. It doesn't look
It's like a fort.
Like a mansion at all.
It's
like a military fort.
It's been used, you know, for a whole heap of reasons, but this is the psychic lightning guy, right? Because there's one particular man who's connected to this entire site. So this particular anecdote was described by, let me just bring it up here, so because it's a very long story.
Let's go with the name.
No, Jesus Torres Peralta.
Not bad.
So he is also a professor researcher at the National Institute of Anthropology and History. So many of them coming from this particular location. But he describes that when he was at this particular site, and you know, with this book, you know, there's a lot of people that are brought in. Actually, no, I messed that one up. I got the wrong person.
No!
I got the wrong person. Oh, that's terrible.
Dude, no one cares about the name.
Oh, okay. Well, look, it's all in the
tell
book.
Tell us the story.
Like, it's all in the book. But this is the actual paranormal investigation site, right? So this is where one of the people that's been involved in it, right? He's somehow involved with the archaeological team. And he previously has been struck by lightning, right? And when he's struck by lightning, he's fine. Like, he's okay. But it brings about this term, which is called the Graniceros.
What's that?
So the Graniceros, people that are struck by lightning and survive, are considered to have the ability to possess perceptions and heightened sensitivity that normal people cannot see or feel.
Didn't you just do a segment on this a few weeks ago?
Yeah, along those lines, right? But this is an actual term that's believed. So when they bring this guy in for this, you know, particular location, for this Palace of Cortez, he comes in. And he's just like, there's something really weird about that wall there, because they're looking at this large wall and there's what appears to be like a fireplace, this very large fireplace that's there. And as they're wandering around, they know that this place was modified. They said the building has been modified. This particular room that they were in, it had been split into a dining room and a kitchen, and this fireplace was moved. And, you know, there's something going on between, you know, 1629 and all this kind of stuff, like not really that important. But it has this big, you know, standing in history, right? It's been used for a whole range of different things. And up until recently, I believe, like the 1800s, it was used for small businesses and warehousing and storage and that kind of stuff. And but there's always been this history, like this weird history of things that were going on. But you've got this man by the name of Theo. And Theo is repairing this crack that's in this kind of in the wall. And it's right near the fireplace. As he does, and he's repairing it and doing what he does, this little object falls out. And he's like, oh, what the hell's that? And he opens up the object and he's like, oh, it's like a cross. It's like this like charcoal black cross. And he said, oh, that's kind of strange. But as soon as that is released, it's like it unleashes just this weird phenomenon that's going on.
Or was there something placed in the wall to protect the property or something?
Maybe. Well, I get the impression that it's like a...
like a talisman.
Yeah, like it's some type of like appeasing talisman or some type of protective amulet or something like that. But when that's in there, right? So he goes to the leader of this project. This is Don George. And
Don George! Yeah,
Theo's like, he's like trembling and petrified.
Don George
is like, what's wrong with... No, he doesn't know what's up. He's like, what's wrong with you? What's going on? And this Theo is like, I'm sorry, but I can't. I can't be here anymore. I can't. He's like, why? Like, what? Just tell me. He's like, look, I was working on the fireplace. I was on the little stool, reaching into the fireplace flue. I was restoring it. And suddenly I felt a very large and strong hand grab me upon the shoulder, pulled me, lifted me up, and slammed me against the floor. My mason's trowel was thrown from my hand, and then a shadow emerged from the fireplace and came towards me and went through me. Hmm. He says, when this shadow went through him, it was like the worst feeling that he'd ever had. It was this horrible sense that came through. And he says, I'm not going back. There's just no way I'm going back. So he's like, okay, I get it. You know, like that's very silly, but fine. You know, you don't have to go back. Now, the excavation team had heard about what had happened, and straight away, they're just like, this has been happening to us. Like we've seen entities. There was two workers from a distant village that had previously fled and they'd been sleeping in there. They'd been sleeping in one of the rooms because they couldn't afford to just travel back and forth every single day. And they're like, they woke up in the middle of the night to find this entity kind of in this black cloak manifesting before them. Other workers had said that these beings are around in the offices and in the other parts of the building. And like really the feeling that everyone was having is that this was like a horrible kind of vibration was now permeating out through this building, like this very old building after this talisman has been removed, right? So word gets around. I don't know how it works, but word gets around where this paranormal investigative team kind of hears that there's strange happenings and goings on at this particular site. So it just so happens that they have a permit. I don't know. Again, I don't know how you have a permit to enter an archaeological site to perform exorcisms or paranormal investigations, but apparently they did. And so the project leader in this case is like, well, you got a permit, so you can come in. So they do. So they bring in, though, these really sensitive microphones. And they bring in, apparently, like they've got all the other kinds of equipment. Well, they've got all the other kinds of equipment, like EMF meters and all that ghost busting stuff. But for them, they focus on the audio recordings.
Are they trying to get EVPs or something?
They're trying to get EVPs. So they come into this site and they were like, we know what's going on here. It's like now that you've peeled back these layers, you've unleashed all the entities. Like they've all started coming through. And of course, like what entities? Like I know people are saying stuff, but what are you talking about? Like, you know, we've experienced this before. Church, chapels, you know, these locations, this stuff happens. So they grab hold of one of these highly sensitive microphones and they record into this space in the room. And when they record into the space in the room, they get the contributor here to come and listen. And he picks up the headphones and he starts listening. And he's like, what the hell is that? What the hell is that? He says, the sound of friar chants, like Gregorian chants, can be very faintly heard in the background. And this is in the office. Right, it's not even connected anywhere else into the room. It's like it's been a 2-year journey.
You know,
to get, like, what is this? He found out that this particular site had actually been used to house a group of Franciscan friars that had been expelled from another location at some point. And this is like in the 16th century, 17th century or something, right? And in this office was also now destroyed, but this wooden
this
altarpiece.
Kind of
yeah, that, well, it wasn't the bell, but this chanting. It's like, how can you... How is the building generating this? So he's impressed by the results from the parapsychologists. And he says, look, I encourage them to explore the fireplace room itself because this is where this little amulet was and perhaps, you know, we could work out what was going on. So they do. They point their microphones toward this particular fireplace. And they say this like, he said, I stood in front of it and expressed my keen interest in what they could find about this particular place. And the man with the ability to perceive with his closed eyes, so this is the guy that was struck by lightning, he claims that as he was watching, that an entity, a black, large, cloaked entity, jumped out and emerged from the fireplace. It ran past them and he could feel pain and sorrow, like anguish. And he's like, I'm sorry, I can't. And now, of course, as the paranormal, you know, researchers are looking at this, like they're really excited. They're rubbing their hands together. So they point their microphones and he puts on the headphones. And he says, the sound that it made sent shivers down my spine. It makes my skin crawl every time I remember it. He said, in the background, he said it was faint, but clear and distinct. It was the sounds of moans, weeping, sobs, and groans. It was absolutely horrible.
Now,
Yeah, pretty much.
That
right?
kind of sound?
That's horrible, like just truly, dementedly horrible. And this just keeps on going. Now, it takes him a couple of years, and that's what, you know, obviously these stories, you know, because they're only, you know, a few pages together, very much compressed. But it takes a couple of years. He doesn't know anything. It's just fascinating to him that he heard this, but you know, the tapes were blank, like all that kind of stuff has been eliminated from it. But he says later, years later, I had the opportunity to research this particular site and I found a very old document about the Palace of Cortez. And during that, I discovered that in colonial times, this mansion had actually been the headquarters of the Holy Office of the Inquisition. And that very room, the fireplace room, had been adopted for interrogation and torture. The Black Cross, we later on found out, had been used during the same era for exorcisms. So it's like it was an exorcist's cross that was used essentially as a talisman. So, you know, terrifying kind of
Never,
stuff.
Never, ever renovate. That's the moral of this entire book.
Yeah. So then though, we come to the stories of the underworld, and there's two stories that come from beneath the Pyramid of the Sun. Now I've got two images here for you, Ben, three images that I want you to bring up. I'm going to make this kind of a little bit shorter. These stories, they're totally separate. Like they're isolated stories, but it's just fascinating that it relates to exactly the same location in Teotihuacan. And we're only recently talking about, you know, Teotihuacan, which was that incredible city, you know, for the time, 125,000 people back. And with that last episode we did with 536 or 535, when, you know, the world was enveloped with darkness because of potentially a volcano erupting. Yeah. This is one of these locations where you have this Pyramid of the Sun. Now, in 1971, underneath the Pyramid of the Sun, they found a tunnel, this strange tunnel. Now, this tunnel is roughly, 7 to 8 meters deep below ground. It's under, you know, thousands of tons of volcanic rock, if not more. And it was also, I think it was like 105 or 106 meters long, something like that. And these archaeologists don't entirely know what it was used for. What they do know is that there was a wall. It's like it walled off something. It was a very heavy wall that had been taken down. But it was pretty clear that the people that built it had wanted to block this space. And beyond this wall, which is now down, which the tunnel leads into, is a set of galleries. Yeah, so if you look at this image here, if you zoom in, Ben, so that orangey kind of image there, that's the staircase that you can enter through. And then that's the majority of the pyramid there on the left. Now, Ben, if you go to the next image, this is another one previous.
Oh. It's upside down. That's all I got.
Oh, there wasn't another one?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
That's it, buddy.
Oh, that's a shame. I thought there was. I must have. Oh, there it is. There it is. Go back. Okay. So in this particular image here, right, this is just from another angle, but this is demonstrating the tunnel, right? So this is the tunnel that's far beneath the pyramid. And as you can see, Ben, it heads directly beneath the pyramid, like
right
under with these chambers, right? Now, with these chambers, it breaks. It's like a
porn collection.
Probably,
there.
Yeah. It breaks off into like this three or four clover leaves, right? And a central cardinal kind of point right in the center. And you can go into this particular spot. And that's exactly what these two contributors have done. They're both archaeologists. So I'm going to mix these stories together a little bit. First, you've got Jesus Peratala. So he's also from the National Institute. He describes this really fascinating scene where basically what he would do is his office was based kind of in the distance, not too far from the pyramid. So he can see the pyramid at night. And he says at 10 o'clock, there's all this other stuff that's like this vast kind of like archaeological or sacred land that's, you know, in front of him. Not sacred, but archaeological, right? And so he has this cleaner that's in his office building. And the cleaner normally will come in because he'll be there working at night and working on whatever he was writing and publishing his journal entries. And the cleaner would just come and have a chat with him. But this one particular evening, the cleaner comes along and he's like, oh, you know, just, I'm really just freaked out, you know. And he says, well, why? I'm like, why are you freaked out? And the cleaner says, well, you know, while I, last night, you know, I was sitting in this, in the hall, and I had my blanket over me, and some invisible force just came along and grabbed hold of me and ripped my blanket from me and threw my stuff across the room. And of course, you know, being an archaeologist, you know, Jesus is just looking at him and he's like, oh, okay. Yeah. You know, like that. Interesting. And like, where did this ghost come from? What is, he's like, oh.
Totally skeptical, right?
Yeah, totally skeptical. He's like, oh, yeah, it in the painting. And he's like, it's like, it's in the painting, right? And he's like, oh, okay. And he just keeps on yada, 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 yada going, right? And he's like, oh, look at his watch. He says, I have to get going because if it closes like at 10 o'clock, I can't cross through this particular location. And so the guy keeps on going. He's like, I've got to go. I've got to run. So he leaves, right? Just thinking about, oh, this ghost's around. Like, that's kind of weird and kind of strange, but, you know, nothing to it. Except as he's wandering across this particular location, which is right on top of the pyramid, he says this woman appears in his peripheral vision. And this woman is stalking him. Like, not an actual person. It's some type of, like, ghostly entity. Because she's got long black hair. She's in this white cotton gown.
Is it a woman, though?
Well...
I'm pretty skeptical at this point.
That's a good question.
You can never tell.
Well, but I'm not sure, right? I'm not so sure, right? But as this woman is kind of pursuing him, he stops because he's freaked out, and she stops. It's like the Bigfoot stories, you know, where these things kind of, you stop and it stops. And so it stops, and then he keeps on, and he just finally makes a run for it. Like, he makes his run for it, and he's like, oh my God, like, what was that? Like, it feels like it was a ghostly entity of some kind. But the night goes, but the problem is that he goes up into his room, and his room is like on the second or third floor. Like, there's no way that someone could reach up to it. And he's like, whatever was following him was now at the window and was tapping on the window.
Great.
And he's like tapping on the window, and he actually writes that he was so terrified that he pulled the blanket over his head, and he was, you know, just freaked out, pardon me, by what was going on. And then the day comes, right? The night ends and the day comes. And it's like, that's weird. Like, it's just, but not connected to anything. There's like no connection with it whatsoever. Until, of course, he finds out that he has a group of students that come along. And these group of students are, you know, fascinated by the Pyramid of the Sun, and they ask if they can go into the tunnels. And these tunnels are not for the general public. Like, this is something for people that have got, you know, important, you know, academic motivations, sure, as opposed to mere curiosity. And so they're all excited. He's like, yeah, we can do that. Like, it's a unique and unrepeatable experience, I suppose, unless you walk in there again. And you can go into the tunnels. So they do. And he writes in this book about the elements about it. So normally with this particular tunnel, there's no air down there. Like, it's really hard to get any air. So you only go in groups of five or so. And you can walk in. It's very limited and it's very small. And he says, we descend this 7-meter metal staircase, and which provides tunnel access. And we start heading through the tunnel. And he says, what's weird about it is as we're heading through the tunnel, normally the oxygen levels get lower and lower and lower. And you can feel it. Like, it fatigues you, yeah, and yeah, you can feel. And he's like, no, he's like, I can breathe really well. We can all breathe really well.
Is that just a hallucination and they're really dying?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. But he's like, this is kind of weird. So he keeps on moving through, and it's a complete darkness except for the beams that were coming from their torches. And they get into this particular area, which has been previously closed off. And there's like water dripping through the stone duct, and it's all very kind of already has a supernatural feel to it. But he gets his students to perform this task, and it's very simple. He says, look, just close your eyes, sit and meditate. And just go with whatever you're guided by, like inside your mind. So your thoughts, and not implying entities or anything else like that, right? And they open their eyes, and people are like, oh my God, they can see auras above people's heads, like each and every, and he's like, well, and it's funny how he treats it. Like, it feels like he treats this as being like, that happens every time. And it's like, it's not a big deal for him, and it must be the effect. And now he starts saying, look, you know, I was very academic and eloquent explaining to them that this is some kind of optical effect retained by the visual memory of the brain. I'm like, mate, you're in this sacred location. It's got some weird geometry in it, and people are seeing, you know, lights above people's heads after this. Maybe there's more to it. But I think he comes to that kind of idea later on, because there's this woman sitting next to him. She's freaked out. Like, she's completely freaked out. He's like, oh, maybe you'd like to share your experience. He's like, what's wrong? And she's got these wide eyes, like these really wide eyes. And he said that her look was like an obsidian knife, like cutting into him. And it's almost like she's possessed by something. And she's like, he's here. And she's, and he's like, what? What are you talking about? She says, I have by my side at this very moment a young man who is not of this time. He's whispering in a language that I don't understand, but he's trying to talk to you. And she's like, he says, I'm, you know, this hardened unbeliever. Like this, I can't believe what my ears are hearing. And he's like, oh, you're being silly. And she's like, no, no, he wants to talk to you.
Who is this woman? She's just part of the group.
Just a random student, right? Okay. It's just part of the group. But she's tried to have this experience and the entity inside this is now trying to get through to him. So he dismisses it, right? He just dismisses it and says, okay, you know, like, okay, that's really great. But he's still, there's something going on because he's got this shiver in his body.
You need to converse with the entity because they can tell you where to dig.
Yeah,
where
right.
to find stuff.
Exactly. So he doesn't think too much of it until Jesus later on, he leaves, right? He takes the five of them out and he gets the second group to come through. Now the second group comes through and he repeats the whole experience, right? And he repeats it with the, you know, these other kids or these other students. And this time the young man to his right, once again in the North Gallery facing a certain way, repeats exactly the same thing that the woman had said. The guy was back and he was like trying to get this other guy to get his attention. And he's like asking him, he's like, what? He's like, look, I don't know. He's not from this era. He's speaking in a strange language. I can't even get it. I don't know what it is, but something is trying to connect with us. And this was happening beneath this great pyramid. So the idea is here is that whether it was directly targeting Jesus or just the actual function of this pyramid was to provide access and communication to otherworldly or interdimensional beings. And it's now long been lost. Our understanding of that is gone. And yet you have an archaeologist that goes down there, you know, very up until this point, hardline, hard-nosed skeptic, and having these repeated experiences where they didn't talk to each other. The two students didn't talk to each other.
Is that what they're suggesting in the book? That's the actual function of the
building? No,
the
it doesn't go into that because it's just an anecdote.
Okay.
All these stories, they feel like they're things that you would never see published in a journal. And indeed, like when I went looking
sure,
for them,
of course.
I couldn't find. It's like there's nothing. Like there's none of it whatsoever. But it is good that they've wanted to put their names forward, you know, to describe what's going on. But then you have the second experience. And I can go, look, it's cool. You know, it's a tunnel. We've heard some of the stories about, you know, what's happened underneath the pyramids in Egypt. You know, even Crowley was in one of them at one point. You know, there's all strange stuff going on. If you recall, there was that great book by, was it the, I can't remember if it was the, who's the guy that wrote the
1996 classic, The Cube?
No, not the 1996 classic, The Cube. We're not going back to The Cube. I'll come back to it in a moment. Anyway.
Robert De Niro.
It wasn't Robert De Niro. So anyway, I'll come back to it. The point is, right, is that there's a multitude of people that have had experience in these pyramid locations. And the impression is, you know, the suggestion is that, well, they act as like accumulators for psychic energy or communication with otherworldly beings. Who really knows what's going on? But in this particular experience, so I'll come down here and I'll bring up. So this is Lewis Cruz. He's also an archaeologist, obviously, from the National School. And he describes this very intriguing story where essentially a group of students contact him and he's got access. Like he's one of the gatekeepers to have access to this particular, you know, temple, this pyramid of the sun. And they say to him, look, we've got a friend and we'd like to take him down into the galleries of the temple. And he's like, why? Like, why would you need to do that? Like, are you just showing, no, he's paralyzed and we think we can perform a ritual down there.
Oh my gosh. Right. Okay.
And he's like, I'm interested. Like, he's interested, right? So he's like, okay, fine. Yep. If you want to do that, how many people are you taking? And it's like, oh, it's not many, but you know, we'll take him down there. So a fully quadriplegic guy, they carry him down this 6 or 7 meter spiral metal staircase.
Didn't you tell this story on the Plus Show?
No, I just this is what I
wasn't there another story of someone who had a.
No, I hinted at it.
Oh, okay.
This is the story that I hinted at, right?
We already know what happens.
Well, he was scanned, right? Because what happens is he goes down and they all go down to this tunnel and it's very difficult to access. They try very hard, as I explained in the previous story, you know, and it doesn't say anything about the air or anything that was bad, but they get this guy and they lay him down facing the west exit. They put a camera in front of him. They begin recording. They turn off their flashlights and they proceed to chant. They're doing this weird chant and it was incomprehensible, like completely incomprehensible. And it was darkness. He couldn't see anything. But as this chanting's happening, this sense of time is lost. And he's like, I think we're in the cave for about 2 hours. Like 2 hours. Pardon me that this was taking place. At the end of the chants, they turn on the lamps and they all stand up, except for the quadriplegic, obviously. And they go and watch the video, like inside the temple. And now as they're watching the video, they're fast forwarding through it and they stop because it was complete darkness. But this was an infrared, you know, lens that they had on it. They watch as they're chanting In complete darkness, suddenly emerges a kind of sphere, this phosphorescent green large sphere. It descended from the very top and came down through the chamber, through the gallery, and entered into the head of the paraplegic man or the quadriplegic man on the floor. The sphere then starts illuminating the lateral part of his body and spinning around, illuminating inside with some type of weird phosphorescent green X-ray, spinning in grey tones, sorry, green and grey tones in and out of his body. Now, they're reeling from this shock. Like, they're just shocked. He says this icy feeling starts coming over me, but curiosity.
He must be thinking, I'm going to be cured. This is it. I'm going to walk. I'm just going to leap out of this chair, go for a run.
Well, we don't know what happens to him, right? Because as this is occurring, one of the other people that's there sees a figure. Right, this figure suddenly materializes. Not in the video, this figure just materializes. Now, I don't know, because of the translation, if they can all see it, if only one can see it. But one of the guys there, he goes, it's the guardian. He's here. And this may have been the man that previously was talking to the other students in the other case, trying to get through, right? He says, I can see him. He can see our thoughts. He feels eternal. And there's a great heaviness within him. And he's just like looking, and he kind of describes this out of era kind of figure, right? It's the guardian. It's the guardian of this gallery that they're witnessing. And he's like, I have to get out of here. And they do. They all leave. They all exit the tunnel, drag the guy out in his wheelchair, push his wheelchair back up, 6 or 7 meters.
So a green ball enters into his head,
moves through his body.
And that's it. Like nothing happens?
Nothing. Nothing.
He doesn't get out of his chair?
No, nothing, right? And this is Lewis, of course, is just like, what the hell just happened? Like,
what just happened?
What is going on? So he says that he first of all asks about the guardian. He's like, what the hell did the guardian look like? And it's like, oh, yeah, he was tall, bronze skin, feathered headdress, his arms crossed at chest height. He was just hanging around in the site. He's like, okay, that's interesting. But then everything kind of goes quiet. He says he finds out, a little bit later on, I don't know how much time passes, but eventually he gets in contact with this group and he asks about the fate of their quadriplegic companion. He's excited. He's like, well, maybe the spiritual entities had fixed him. And they go, well, no, actually, one of our other friends who can talk to the spirits, they established communication with these entities, like with this feathered being that was down there. He's like, no, we can't take away his paraplegia or quadriplegia because that's his destiny.
That's right. That's what you mentioned on the Posh Show.
That's his karma.
He had to deal with it.
They couldn't get rid of it.
Well, that's a shame.
Yeah, it is a shame. But it's just amazing that people are having, this is coming from archaeologists. This is coming from, people that are supposed to be in the space of having, very, academic focus and, not kind of given to this kind of stuff. But there's this other story I want to describe to you from Thomas Cordova. And I think Thomas Cordova, that name's familiar. I think we've touched on some of his work before. But again, he's from Harvard University, I believe, or has been associated with Harvard University. But basically, he goes through this story, which I won't go into great detail. Pick up the book and translate it. Or if you speak Spanish, grab the book.
It's great. Translate it.
But he describes this really cool incident where he goes into this particular location. And when he goes into the location, it's just on the outskirts of Mexico City. Mm-hmm. And he finds that they're kind of, very carefully, he says it's like performing a delicate surgery, excavating this site. And as they're excavating the site, they come across this sculpture. It's about 60 centimeters high. And he says it's exquisite. Like it's just this beautiful sculpture. And they want to try and get it out. And they're trying to get it out. And they've got three men are trying to pull this thing. There's nothing holding in place. There's no mortar or anything like that. There's no reason for this to not be able to be moved. And they bring in pulleys and they start trying to pull it out and they hook it up to a car and they can't move it, right? And he's like, what is going on? And he's like, in some archaeological digs, sometimes there's a pin. There's some weird pin, somewhere in the back of it attached to it. So he starts trying to look for a pin. There's just nothing, right? But somehow there was an obsidian blade. There was this obsidian blade on the back of it. And what he does, he runs his hand over. He's like, ah! And as soon as he pulls his hand back.
Still sharp.
It's still sharp. It cut and this blood is going everywhere, right? And as soon as that happens, the sculpture just air goes.
What? This is Indiana Jones stuff.
He's like, I realized what it was. Only a blood offering could be provided in exchange for its freedom.
Wait, so what's happening to the, what's going woof? What does that mean?
It's suddenly not as heavy as you'd expect. But
they can move the statue.
They can pause. Yeah.
Yeah, you're doing motions.
I'm doing motions, which not a lot of people.
I don't know if that was a ghost. I don't know what that motion was.
As he cuts his hand, the structure just suddenly releases.
Okay.
Like it just suddenly moves. And it's like still a stone, like it's a 60-centimeter, stone object, but it's not heavy. It's like maybe 10 kilos or something. It just moved. Like three men, a car and pulley system could not move this thing from its spot. The moment he cuts himself with some weird obsidian sharp thing built into the back of it, he does this offering, he could move it. So it's like this whole...
So it's not a mechanism or anything. It's not like some kind of Scooby-Doo thing where they find a hidden wheel. It's magic, right?
No,
it's some kind of... It's an occult thing.
Yeah. And there's one other story that I'll give you before we go into our plus extension. It's the story of Paquito, right? So this is described by Diaz and Gonzalez. They're both graduates from the School of Anthropology. They've just got like very little anecdotes of experiences that they've had. In fact, there was one that was described by Gonzalez where he said that much like the Singapore, remember Singapore with the falling marbles? Have you heard with Singapore, so people in apartment buildings say that they hear the sound of falling marbles and rolling across their building or in their apartments, but they can't ever find the sound. He describes something similar. He says, look, there's been times where I've been working alone in particular locations, restoration, locations, when I've heard what sounds like a large marble falling to the ground and rolling across the ground. Now, he says, I go to check.
The conventional explanation is that this is pipes, right?
Right, that's right. Yeah, that's pipes.
Because I've heard that sound a bunch of times.
Yeah, we all have. But he says he went to look for the marble because it sounds like it wasn't a marble. It sounded like a heavy metal ball. He said, in the spot where the marble had fallen, you can see that the tile has been smashed.
Oh.
But there's no marble anywhere. And he says, then after the tile was replaced... Once again, I heard the marble and the tile was smashed. So it's like this weird kind of poltergeist-like kind of experience. But then, and this comes up in a number of these cases, and I might do one in the plus extension just before we get into it. But there's this one particular story where I think it's Diaz. She goes into a particular site. It was during the pandemic, so it was difficult to move around. She finally gets approval to be able to go to one of these sites. And she heads into this particular location in this old building. And when she's in the building, she says like, oh, it's very peaceful, but there's a skeleton there, right? That's been discovered. It's being worked on. And because of the pandemic, it's been ignored for a long period of time. So she's like, she finally gets to work with it. And she starts removing the dirt and the layers from it. And, she has a great day at work and then she comes home. Now, when she goes home, she's sitting watching television with her sister. She goes to the bathroom. When she comes back, her sister is freaked out, like really freaked out. She's like, what's wrong? What the hell's wrong with you? And she's like, a boy about 15 years old. He was wet. He had brown hair. That was wet as well. His eye sockets were completely black. His skin had purple skin tones. He just walked into the room and dematerialized before me.
Oh my
God. And she's like, oh my God. Because what she'd been doing all day.
He sounds sick. He sounds like he needs to go and get a shot of something.
Well, she called
the medication.
She called it Paquito. But basically, when she was performing the restoration or the fixing of this skeleton, the maintenance of this skeleton, they worked out that it possibly was a 12 to 15-year-old boy that had fallen in the river, had been of ill health, so that's why he would have had purple skin. But the eyes being black in the skull, when she was restoring the skull, in the eye socket was the tip of a blade of a knife. And so that's possibly how he had died. And it was like she believes that this was some type of restless spirit that had come home with her from the skeleton. And that's something else that comes up a lot. And I will describe, one of those stories in the plus extension coming up where people bring these things home. They go to sites. There was a really great example of a guy that was diving. And when he was diving, he'd gone into, one of these spectacular holes, like these deep caves that are full of water. And they're all through the Yucatan. Like they're really spectacular. And he'd gone down and there must have been some... importance to this particular site because he dives down and he gets stuck. Like he sees his friend start to struggle because there's something wrong with his vest kind of inflates. It just suddenly inflates for no reason. So he's struggling. He's up against a wall because he can't surface. He's trying to get him out and he pulls it and he gets to the surface and he brings this guy up when all of a sudden they're trying to bring him up and they're trying to back this truck that they've got with him on a rope and they can't bring him up because there's just so much weight on him. And it even seems like he's being pulled down, right? Is there something going on? And apparently we find out later on, for people that are familiar spiritually with the site, this particular site where he'd been diving was known to be infested with the Lushas, which are those little goblin-type creatures, right? And these are Lushas, 10 or 12 of them had latched onto him as he was coming up. Now, no one could see it, but they could see the effect of the weight upon him of where they could not pull him out. And somehow these...
Did he get out? Did he drown?
Yeah, somehow he managed to get pulled out. And I think because they said a prayer or something, or paid respects to the site, something like that.
Throw a gold coin in.
Yeah, and they all just disappeared and he was able to be pulled out. And this is the kind of thing that's repeated, you know, many of these times, of these people being affected by these invisible entities and forces. So truly a difficult book if you don't speak English, but if you don't speak Spanish. So translate, but it truly is... fascinating. Like if you've got the time to sit and go through it, and it really is an incredible story of, it demonstrates that there is far more to the world than the material, far more.
Yeah. It's interesting that it's, it's modern academics really. I mean, this is an academic field.
Yeah.
And it is their real names. It is their real identities. It's not pseudonyms.
It's their real names. It's their real stories.
How would you know though?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, but then again, I guess you could look these people up to see, you know, if they're at these institutions and these universities.
I did. None of them exist.
Of course they do. But yeah, I mean, it's just like some of the stories in here. I mean, many of them, though, I find to be fascinating in the sense that animals can see them, right? There was a woman that was working on this one particular site, and as she went into the site, everything was fine, right? There's just monkeys around and it was fine. She goes into the site, spends all day at the site, and all of a sudden all these things like attached to her, but she doesn't know, but she starts feeling fatigued and she feels uncomfortable. So she starts wandering back, and as she wanders back, all the monkeys go apeshit. Like they just go absolutely nuts, like unlike, and they're staring at her and they're freaked out and they're aggressive. And she's like, what the hell? And she goes back into her camp. And it's funny, I don't know if the word cook is a way to describe like either a spiritual person or if they're, I don't know what it is, but in many of these stories, they get back to their base camp and the cook is like, yeah, you've got entities attached to you. You caught them at the site over there and we have to do an offering now to get rid of them.
The cook.
So the cook like does alcohol, does like all
it must be a translation issue.
I think it's a translation issue. But then again, maybe it's just the laborers or maybe it's just the people that are familiar with these. And that's exactly what happened. He performs this ritual. All the things went away that she picked up at this site. As soon as she walked past the monkeys again, they're all back to normal.
Well, we're going to shift gear in the Plus extension coming up. We're going to look at Diana Pasulka's new book, Encounters, Experiences with Non-Human Intelligences, the long-awaited follow-up from her 2019 classic American Cosmic. There's some really intriguing stories coming up. As I said, there's an Australian twist as well. And we're going to talk about this idea that the UFO secrecy, those that hold knowledge, they don't write it down. They pass it on orally. It's like an oral initiation in the style of Western mystics going back to Socrates, Plato, and Pythagoras. There's a kind of Gnostic implication that people are initiated into this knowledge. And again, from her previous book, she spoke about this scientist named Tyler, who we know his identity now. But again, he spoke about this hierarchy. And the hierarchy, right above us, there are these individuals that are associated with intelligence agencies, not necessarily the agencies themselves, but are associated with that world and are perhaps part of secret groups, unacknowledged programs, that seem to be part of this oral initiation in regards to UFOs. So we'll talk about that after the break on our Plus extension. If you want to sign up, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. You get access to the big extensions we do on these shows every single Friday. And of course, Plus members get entirely exclusive shows every single Tuesday as well. You're getting more than double the content when you sign up for Plus. Plus members also get access to a higher quality MP3 version of the show, so you're getting a higher sound quality. You also get a totally ad-free version of the show as well. And if you sign up for our MU Max tier, you get access to our massive back catalogue going back 16 plus years of show. So sign up today, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. That's a wrap for this free edition of the show. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Welcome back to your Plus extension. Great to have